say that whenever I refer to a text or I refer to a book that we're using, I'm referring to John Shaw's The Nature Photographer's Complete Guide to Professional Field Techniques, which I highly recommend just as something to have around, because there's some beautiful, inspirational nature images in here. But it also is the book that I would have written about the kinds of material that I'll be presenting. So I strongly encourage you to find that available at any bookstore, and even here at Holden, there's at least a few copies. Now, quickly, I want to find out what your goals are for being here, and want to just start. What type of photography experience do you have? And
well, I was one of those people that have a camera with huge manual and things.
Right.
And I don't take enough pictures to know what I'm doing, and when I do, they're developed months later and I forgot what it was.
Okay.
And that kind of thing. And I also own some lenses and some filters that I don't know what to do with.
Sounds pretty.
So I think I've got all the stuff.
You shoot color prints or slides?
Pardon?
Shoot color prints or slides? Which one?
I used to shoot slides and then I found I didn't look at them.
Okay.
So now I shoot prints.
Okay. Let's go on.
I shoot slides and I've been doing some photography up here and I've been wondering more about how to take the nature shots. just kind of curious what you have to share.
Okay.
Good. Well, I own several 35 millimeters and I have trouble with my pictures getting too dark. I guess I don't understand.
With prints or?
Prints, okay. Yes. I guess I don't understand my camera.
Okay. But I'm continuing to try to establish where we're at here individually. And
I listen to color snapshot.
Sure. With a 35 millimeter?
Yeah.
Okay.
This got a VCR and I'd like to learn more about how to use it.
Okay. And the video machine, tape machine, will have some analogies to this because it really works best when you shoot still images. None of this, or zooming in now. So it'll work, especially come to the composition day.
35 millimeter.
Okay.
35 millimeter photos,
with prints.
Just occasions.
All right.
An occasion.
I saw the sign that said basic and I was in that area.
All right.
But when Kodak had their problem with the Polaroid and its little suit, they enabled you to get one of these.
All right.
And then, so I got one and I can learn more about it.
Okay, corner me afterwards. We can look at that particular camera and see what
okay.
you can do.
Thank you.
I'm very novice. I just have a 35 millimeter all automatic camera.
Okay.
So I'd just like to find out how to get more in depth and where to start.
All right. Prints or slides?
Going prints. I have a 35 millimeter prints and slides.
Okay,
I like going out and just shooting for fun, but I guess came for some ideas.
All right. Well, I love photography and I love to share the information. It's also a very expensive hobby. And it has some severe impacts on our environment too, which we need to talk about as we go along in terms of resources. So one of the things about getting better at photography is to reduce the impact that photography has by all the bad ones that we end up with. However, you cannot become better at photography without taking photos. So one of the things we're going to try to organize is maybe a walk even this afternoon after lunch. I spied some marvelous mushrooms down on our little nature trail here. Anyway, you simply have to do it, but there's some real basic kind of things as well as more intermediate and advanced. Perhaps we can learn from each other as well. Let me skim through the slides. First of all, I wanted to use this image to let you know that it is a very fragile place we live. It's a very tiny, tiny envelope. And how did we discover that? Through a photograph and through science, of course. But it wasn't until the astronauts brought back this image that suddenly our consciousness was really raised to this green blue planet that we live on. And actually it's called the blue planet. I wanted to share also with you these words from John Muir, my personal hero in terms of life and the environment. I care to live only to entice people to look at nature, climb the mountains and get their good tidings. Nature's peace will flow into you as the sunshine into the trees. The winds will blow their freshness into you and the storms their energy, while cares will drop off you as autumn leaves. I often think that he would have been a marvelous photographer. In fact, he said, I only live to be like a crystal through which people can see the world. Though he used the written word rather than the photograph. So I would challenge us all to use photographs for that purpose, to show nature in a way that will help other people relate to specific places, but also to relate to you as a human in that spot in nature. Because each of us has a very unique vision as we look at things. So don't imitate mine. Don't imitate anybody else's necessarily all your life, but it's good to look at how other people do photos. Quickly, John Muir is the man in the beard next to Teddy Roosevelt there in front of the tall trees in Yosemite. Teddy Roosevelt supposedly slept under 32 blankets that night and enjoyed the snow, and Muir was instrumental in getting him enthused about protecting our environment. Images like this also excite me, as the images of Holden Village here, because we can travel through time. You go up to that museum and you look at those faces of the men and women who spent time up here, and each of you has family photos that date back decades. By the way, we're in our 151st year here of photography, so we're still a very, very early art form or life form. Life, this image is a little dark for here, but it was an image of sewage being dumped into a river in Wisconsin. And again, shifted people's mentality. There was this huge dramatic shift in mentality in the Midwest when these types of images started to appear about pollution in rivers. And of course, color photography had a lot to do with that. So it is a powerful, powerful tool. We're going to talk about equipment, everything you need, right? This is the maximum way to go. This is the minimum way to go. We're going to talk about tripods. This is John Shaw, our author. If you notice, you have to let the mosquitoes bite you while you're taking your photo. We're going to talk about the PhD camera, light meter, and believe me, this is the biggest problem all of you are going through right now, because that PhD push here dummy light meter controls everything for most photographers, 90%. After even this first hour today though, you'll be able to go back to your camera and control it in a much more positive way. You also can see the solution. I have one in my pack, a red shirt. And that's the first thing that will improve your images. Always have somebody wearing red. The rest of this week we're going to work on developing your eye for color. And I came up here this fall expecting the larch to be gorgeous. And of course it's not here yet. And I want the aspen to be gorgeous, and it's not here yet. I'm going, oh. But I took that walk along the river down there, and the mushrooms are incredible. There's more color in the mushrooms right now than I've ever seen in some anywhere. And I haven't been on the 10 Mile Creek hike yet, but I anticipate the same. You should hear backlit explodes with color, and it's possible with color slides or color prints to capture color in a way that even our eye doesn't see it. But let me say again what I heard you saying. What I see when I take the photograph doesn't end up in the photograph. Now that's the problem most photographers have. And we're going to attack that today with several things that you can use to deal with just that problem. See beyond the ordinary. Well, we're in the extraordinary place. But you just need to look around. This is anybody have the technical term? It's a snow plant. It grows in the springtime in Sierra Nevada. This is a trick photograph, multiple exposures of a moonset, zooming at the same time, so with a zoom lens. You don't need to do that, but it's fun to learn how to do that. This is a chart showing resolution, and we'll talk about how film varies in grain size and contrast, and how all of that affects resolution, how sharp your images are. Again, in many cases, images aren't sharp. We'll talk quickly about filters. See the difference in sky? Polarizing filter. We'll talk about being in the right place at the right time. If those of you are interested in marketing your work, as I say, this is a very expensive hobby, and I sell my photographs whenever possible. As it changes it from a hobby to a business, and all those kinds of things are important to me. There's some ethics involved. This is a beautiful photograph by Joel Meyerowitz over here in BC, but who has he sold it to? And I think we all have to think about how our images are used. My closest friends in the business in 4x5 work are people who have those kinds of ethics. We could talk more about that. This beautiful composition, we're going to talk about composition and look at slides and do composition. Again, red. Notice that the sense, though, that cameras are everywhere. Supposedly, there's one camera per family in all of America. I mean, we're talking a billion photographs a year. Composition and light. Today is actually what I would consider a terrible day for photography. Yesterday was wonderful because of the flatter light. So many of you, many of us shoot photographs in this contrasty light and they don't turn out. And there's a reason for that, called film latitude. Of course, being in the right place. Notice the red socks. And I'm biased about Kodak. Kodachrome 25 in particular, but which this photograph was taken on and then duped on Ektachrome and sold to the Kodak. But now this new Fuji film is just incredible with slides. In terms of print film, the Ektar, of course, is the sharpest. We'll talk about grain. This will be us in a few minutes, except for the backpacks. We'll be out there. Not this morning, but after lunch, if you would like, because I really want to show off these monitors. And of course, what you really need is a camera that automatically has a sign that pops up that says, wrong way. Right? Stop, don't take this image, wait, and just see what happens here. See? Light is everything, and that's what photography is. It's painting with light, it's designing with light. You're waiting for that moment, sometimes all day for the moment. And we'll get to some bad shots later. Selling your work. This is one example of Rainbow Bridge in Arizona, which is in Sierra magazine of mine. But it's tough to compete against the 4x5. It really, really is with 35 millimeter work. So,
what do you mean when you say that the 4x5 people?
Okay, the 4x5 inch piece of film, they are able to do things with their cameras that we cannot in terms of manipulating depth of field, which we're going to talk about tomorrow. So let's save that for tomorrow if we have the time to come. All right. And again, as a way of meditation, perhaps think about what Joseph Wood Crutch wrote in his book, The Desert Year. The rare moment is not when there's something worth looking at. And I think we're experiencing that up here so much. But when we're capable of seeing. Remember what I said about I had thought I was going to see these things when I came up here. I wasn't here yet. So I was blanking out. I wasn't seeing what was available. So think about this. And then also as we gain control over our cameras and our light meters and so on, we'll have more power within us to really see things. Now I'm going to make a list. Ah, thank you. I'm going to make a list up here, but I strongly encourage those of you who are using 35 millimeter cameras in particular to keep a diary record, some notes of how you take images in the future. And remember, somebody said about, I can't remember, it's too long between when I shoot and develop. Well, that's why a diary can be extremely helpful as a growth tool. I'm going to talk about journal writing next week, by the way, and that's just sort of the free edit for that. So why don't our photos look like what we saw? Well, the obvious thing, of course, is that the lens is monocular and our eyes are binocular. All you have to do is walk around like this and it starts to look like what a camera sees. But the biggest problem, and I'm going to develop rule number one right now, the biggest problem is that we blur our photographs just by holding the camera. So, hand motion is the problem. And let me illustrate. Lots and lots of people hold cameras like this. All right? Your body, the diaphragm that provides the air pump in here, moves your whole body, literally. And when you're at any altitude or after walking, all right, you simply cannot hold, most of us cannot hold even 1/125th of a second, or as in your camera, you're not going to be able to hold your camera's automatic shutter speed still enough. Most of us simply provide blur to our images by providing shape from our hands. By the way, this is a technique that you can use always to find out if there's film in your camera. You ever open the back and discover a roll of film that's all over on this side?
Yes.
Always try the crank. And if you feel tension in there, that means there's film in. The other reason that you get camera shape, and the research shows from Nikon and so on, that about 60% of all images that come into the average developing through Kodak are blurred from this motion. The other reason is that mirror in there. Let me slow it down. That mirror has to pop up each time in order for the image to be taken. And that mirror provides a lot of inertia, shape to your camera. So all of us need to learn a very simple technique if you're going to handhold your camera. And I need a lens on here to get rid. First of all, you got to learn how to hold the camera correctly. And for men at least, it's possible to really put your elbows down and breathe carefully, just like a person shooting a weapon or something like that, or bow and arrow. Breathe in, let half out, squeeze, let the air out. Now, if you're not doing that consciously, you're shaking the image and it will look blurry, especially when you make blow-ups. The other rule then that we need to live with, use a shutter speed, and I'll abbreviate that, that's equal to 1 over the focal length of the lens. Now this happens to be a 35 millimeter focal length, but most lenses come with 50 as a normal lens, right? So what would be a shutter speed that would control handshake for a 50 millimeter lens?
150.
Okay, and most cameras, of course, use 160. Mm-hmm. All right. So if you're using a camera with a 50 millimeter or shorter, you simply cannot, you literally, nobody can hold the camera still enough at less than 1/60th of a second. Most of us, especially when you're exercising or moving up and down, need to use 1/125th. Now, who in here uses longer lenses? Zoom lenses, 80 to 120, 135 to 200? What would be the shutter speed for a 200 millimeter lens? The handheld, to freeze the action.
1/200.
1/200, and most of us only have 1/250th, right? You don't have that in between. So go back and look at all of those images you shot handheld with a 200 millimeter lens. And if you shot less than 1/250th, it's going to be blurred. They're not sharp.
What about a zoom?
Okay, zoom, you have to use the longest focal length in the zoom. I have an 80 to 200, which I'll show you in a minute here. And I have to, if I'm hand holding it, I have to be at 1/250, or it's blurred. I shot two rolls and then developed them, not thinking about that when I bought it the first day. And then 1/60th, 1/125th, they're all blurred. Mm-hmm.
So mine is 70 or 1.
35, perhaps, 150, that's hard. Take a look at it.
Yeah.
All right, and the rest of you are just shooting any time. You need to provide a platform, and you need to control your breathing, and the same platform holds for vertical, which, by the way, is another composition rule to improve your work. How many rolls of your prints come back with only horizontal images? Think about it. The world comes vertically. Composition. You also can fill the frame more intensely with vertical, certain scenes, right? But a vertical shot works just as well as a horizontal, but you have to get the platform. You have to find the personal one. And of course, the best platform of all, believe me, and we'll get other reasons for it, is the tripod. This is a very beat up tripod, as is all of my equipment, because I believe photography work should be done in the field, and I really abuse my stuff, but I take care of it. But it's a tool, not a jewel. Okay, you should be using your camera. And a tripod is a very, very stable place, if it's low, and if you buy a decent tripod. You also, then, the higher it gets, or if you switch it from a tripod to what? A monopod? This is useless up here. It's a monopod now, it's not a tripod. So I never, ever raise that up if I can avoid that. So tripod is stable, and the longer the legs get, the less stable. However, you can dangle camera bags or day packs from the middle down through the center of gravity down here and stabilize it. Now I'm going to talk really fast today, as most days, because that's what I'm used to. So if you ever need to ask, jump in here. Rule of thumb, shutter speed that's 1 over the focal length. And you've just improved a whole lot of your work. By the way, you can listen to other photographers. too slow. Really slow, but you hear lots of people with automatic cameras that pick the shutter speed for you, and those of you with automatic cameras never ever let the light meter pick the shutter speed if you're hand holding it. Because what's the light meter think about that? That's wonderful for exposure, but what are you doing? Alright? My favorite light meter story quickly is in a wind cave, and I'll just have to demonstrate because this is a man. This person took an image, click, and the light meter didn't get enough light until he walked by a light bulb over here. Finally, the light meter got enough light, and I've been taking an image all the way along.
Are you going to talk about speeds later?
Yeah, it's coming. But the key thing for handheld work is rule number one. Secondly, your work does not look the same because of depth of field. And we're just going to touch on that today. And now, but I'd like to talk much more about that tomorrow, so please come. And this afternoon, if you'd like to go out with me, we'll start illustrating. The depth of field comes from three things. Does anybody know what the three things are?
Your distance from the subject.
Mm-hmm. And one way to illustrate that, by the way, is to focus, for example, on your thumb here and then further out. The further away you get from something, the more depth of field you have. What else? What are the other two?
Shutter speed.
Not shutter speed, actually has no effect on it. Light has no effect on it.
Aperture.
The aperture, or f-stop. And the third is the type of lens. Focal length. Now, today we're just going to touch on that as a sales pitch come tomorrow. We'll learn to control all that. But basically, focal length refers to the zone of acceptable sharpness from front to back. And most of you now are going to be shooting at 1/125th of a second, right? Or 1/125th or 1/60th. Well, what does that mean? It means you've got to open your f-stop up to f2, to a big opening, to let enough light in there. Well, guess what you've just done? Big opening, or F2, right, has very little depth of field. At 5 feet with a 50 millimeter lens, you have less than 3.5 inches. That's something at 5 feet. That's just not much there. Excuse me, at 2 feet. At 5 feet, you have about a foot. So depth of field is another serious cause of, well, this doesn't look right. But we won't cover much more than that today. Thirdly, PhD light meters. And we'll just write PhD here. I'm not insulting the cameras, I'm not insulting you, but most people have cameras that you can't control. It's automatic, much like your camera. And it's frustrating because of the following reasons, all right? Now, first of all, how many of you have taken photographs of snow? What did the snow look like after you?
Blah.
Yeah, it looks gray. Because that's what the light meter wants it to look like. Light meter doesn't like white to look white. It wants it to look gray. How about a black cat or a black background or whatever? It wants the black to look gray. So, for example, for those of you who are shooting color slides only, to make snow look white, what do you have to do with the lightning? Color slides only. You have to overexpose from what the light meter tells you. Those of you shooting color prints, just the opposite. To make snow look white, you have to underexpose what the light meter tells you.
If you're shooting moonshots...
Mm-hmm. I've got a special handout just on moon.
Oh, okay. So you're trying to get
it to... Yeah, let's deal with moon as a separate issue, and I give everybody a handout. So, what do we got if we're taking a photograph of you with your white or underexposure things that you don't want to have happen? The solution is a relatively simple one, however, only if you have a manual camera or if your automatic camera allows you to do the following kinds of things. If you're metering off a bright subject like this, with a dark background, by the way, and you want the object, you have to meter off the object. You can't stand back here and get a metered average scene. So what is the light meter attempting to do back here? Anybody?
Overall?
Yeah, it's averaging. And what do all the ads in the magazines and newspapers and so on sell with PhD light meters? Averaging. Averaging is the worst possible thing to happen in most scenes because it's contrasting. Or, as you have here, what's behind my bright object? Something dark. And so what is it trying to do? Well, it's trying to average the dark background with this bright object to do what in the end? It overexposes this and brings the dark background to gray, which is a horrible image because I can't even see what the bright object is here. We're going to look at slides tomorrow and in the future this week that really illustrate this problem. The reverse could also be true, by the way, and my first bad shot here will illustrate that. Somebody wearing a hat, right, broad hat. What is it? It's shadow underneath, right? Sunshine on the backs or on the front. Light meter says, I need to average all that out. And what do you get under the hat?
A dark face.
Dark face. Same way with your VCR, your video camera, by the way. They all have automatic metering, so this is just right for you in terms of listening to what. The solution then, in every case, print or slides, is to do some metering first off the light tone, either on the object itself or maybe over here, and then go back and take the photograph. But most people simply are concerned about composition because this PhD meter's got them trained. You just take the photo, you compose, and then you take the image. By the way, I'm not showing good form. Right? Think about it. What's wrong with composing the scene and letting the meter then read and shoot it? What's happening? Average. And that's bad results in most cases.
Well, what do you do when you can't get near the object you're shooting? You're shooting a lion in the zoo and you don't want to walk in there. And
turn and look around for a similar tone, similar light tone.
You can't do it mentally and say, okay, I'm going to change my my f-stop or my speed to compensate.
You can do it mentally if you have for example, that let's say this is our tiger, or that let's use this woman as an illustration because it typically bright, dark background. Well, if I metered that, what is the meter averaging for the most part?
Background.
The black background, which would tell me to let in more light. Now I know that if I really want her to look white with detail and not be washed out, overexposed with color slide, I need to let in less light to make the background go black and to have her portrait appear as is. And we'll practice that The other thing then, and this is true especially for color slides, even on a day like, perfect sunny day like this, your light meter with averaging for color slides, the correct exposure tends to blah the colors. So I'm going to give, so what did we do? First of all, meter then should compose. Now I'm going to give you a second tool that you can use called bracketing. Does anybody know what bracketing refers to in terms of exposure?
Changing your stuff without changing.
Yeah, you've changed, you simply change the amount of light entering the film, either with f-stop or shutter speed, to allow for the film to maybe correct for that light meter. So let's take our portrait here of this bright and dark background. And you trusted your meter the first time, or a flower, or a nature scene. Today is going to be a perfect illustration of this. If you were to go out and shoot any of these hillsides today that are in sunlight, or the village itself, the light in the scene through the meter will result in overexposure.
So it'll wash out.
It'll wash out. Just because it's bright, and but the meter likes to do that. So bracketing refers, in my case, what I do is I trust my meter, and then with color slides, I underexpose a half a stop. Sometimes a full stop. Remember that fuchsia scene with all that explosion of color coming up? That was a minimum of a half stop for what's called color saturation with slides. Now with print film, you have to do just the opposite.
Why is that?
Because it's a negative film. All right, now let's start over. And your question is the key thing here. With color slides, it's a positive film. You're seeing the same thing that you're getting. But with negative film, right, you get the negative and then you make a print. But with color slides, to get the best colors, you need to bracket underexposure. Or you will get, if you underexpose with print film, and that's what I heard partly your problem was, mm-hmm. is that you're getting too dark.
Yeah, so
your prints are always too dark.
Overseas, my pictures are terrible because I have so many dark pictures. Yeah.
Now, first of all, let's do an aside here. All of you should do an experimental roll when you get home, and I'm going to talk about that with my handout. Or shoot it up here and write down the notes and so on. Yes?
In the automatic camera, you put the roll of film in, and I gather the camera picks up the speed of the
right,
film.
Right.
Off of the, and
you're stuck.
Okay, and then when does it, can it discriminate between slide film?
Yes.
And is there a different code?
Well, it will only discriminate on ASA or ISO number as we're now using, but it won't discriminate in terms of the result.
Yeah, at least it will make one discrimination between what you were saying, a slide film has a little different rating as over against a
No, I misspoke. I misunderstood your question. It only reads the ASA or ISO number. And if that's all the control you have on your camera, you're stuck in terms of bracketing.
Yeah.
You can't do it. So if you really want to make progress, your next camera has to be one with automatic and manual modes. And you can get just a manual camera, the Pentax K1000, for $125 with a 50mm lens. Just manual. The cheapest automatic, I don't know what, $250 probably, or less. 200. That's a lot of money for a toy. You want to be serious about it.
Well, if you were using film that can... this one, Seattle's got this one film, you can send it in,
right.
Prints and slides,
right.
Then you couldn't underexpose and overexpose.
I wouldn't know
wrong one way.
I wouldn't know what to do with that film, and I highly unrecommend it.
Oh.
I highly unrecommend it.
I wasn't very satisfied with it.
Because you never know what it's, how it's been stored, and, you know. It's old movie film.
I didn't know it was old movie film.
Yeah, and it's been around. And you don't know how it's been stored, don't use it, is my recommendation.
Mm. What film is
it's
that?
It's 52, 47, 52, 47, 41, and it gives you slides and prints. I really don't recommend it.
I used it and I wasn't happy with it.
We'll get, there's another issue of film here coming up. So bracketing is taking the photograph as your light meter tells you and then either overexposing or underexposing. And in some cases, that means both. For example, yesterday, there was a scene with this incredibly bright mushroom down at that end of the nature walk. Had some reds. Well, reds in Kodachrome slides with overexposure actually become a softer pastel color, which is wonderful. Underexposure, the reds become vibrant and sharp reds. So it's a matter of aesthetics. Now let's talk about one more metering scene. How many of you saw the Four Seasons slideshow? Those of you who have, I recommend it. Or in your own work, where the sky is perfectly exposed and what's the hillside or the people down here? They're too dark. Or the people up here look just right and what's the sky do? It washes out. The next problem that we're looking at is an issue of film latitude. Oops, I guess I shouldn't let that sit out. Better dry out. The best slide film in terms of film latitude is Kodachrome 25 because it allows two stops from bright to dark. And if we can use you as an illustration again, she is in contrasty light against the dark background. Now that as I meter, let's say her shirt would be F8 at 1/60th. But the shadow detail is probably easily behind her, F2, which is 4 stops. Guess what results from a film that has not enough latitude, this is print or negative, between the darkest and the brightest area. What's the result from too contrasty a scene in the print or the slide? Something has to happen if the latitude won't cover it. We'll either get overexposed or underexposed, leaving either dark or white areas. Overexposed in slides. All right. Now with print film or negative film, ASA 400 would give you lots of latitude, just like Kodachrome 25 gives you lots of latitude in slide film. However, those of you shooting prints, what happens to the molecule size in the film, the grain size, as you go to higher and higher ASA.
It gets bigger.
Pretty soon there are big lumps in the image from the grain. If you've ever shot 1,000 or that new stuff.
The 1600.
Yeah, 1600.
1600 is fine in the cathedral.
Right. But it's grainy, and it's and ultimately, though, it has lots of latitude. That's why I use Tri-X or now the new T-Max 400, because it has lots of latitude for negative film. However, you're trading off grain size or sharpness for latitude.
So on the grain, more accurate?
Just a second.
The grain, if it's more grainy, what kind of pictures is it suitable for? Is it like landscape?
Yeah.
Or individuals? Yeah.
It's suitable for whatever you want in that light condition. Or go back to a slower film and buy a tripod. Or use flash.
I see. Uh-huh.
And using flash is a very allowable nature photography, or in your life, any of you, that's available light. You carry it with you. It's available. All right. So your question is right on the mark in terms of where we're our transition here. You are constantly making a trade-off, all of you who are not using tripods, between fast film and grain, which reduces the quality, ultimately, of your image, because of the grain size. But it gives you more latitude, and it gives you more ASA to shoot in darker conditions. However, you can use a light, for example, a light tripod. Whoops, it's on my other camera. Let's just illustrate it here. Let's imagine that. Push the timer or use a cable release at 1 second here. I mean, that results in equally perfect exposure as five hundredth of a second. And let's just illustrate that quickly. 1/500th at f2 is the same image as 2/50th at f2.8. Stop there, it goes to 2, and then 1 second, this is 1/2, right? What am I getting here at 1/4 of a second at f22, with f22? Lots of depth of field. The same scene at 1/500th of a second at f2, how much depth of field? Very little. So that's a long answer than I suspect you anticipated. And you had a question.
You're just talking about latitude. Mm-hmm. What I hear you say is that if you have more latitude, you're not going to have the contrast, you're not going to have the dark background and then the lighter shirt.
It
won't have.
You will get a more correct image with more latitude. However, with print or negative film, you're getting bigger and bigger grain, which reduces the ultimate quality. However, with slide film, the lower the ASA and the smaller the molecules or grain, the better the latitude. Those of you who shot slides like Ektachrome 400, horribly contrasty result always occurs because it overexposes the brights and underexposes the darkest areas, and you only get this little bit in between of correct latitude. And that's why so many photographers today are now using the Fuji 100 or Fuji 50, because it has probably equal latitude to Kodachrome 25 as a slide film. So I recommend the Fuji 50 or Fuji 100 as a slide film. So your question ties in with something I don't think I finished off. Remember that sky scene, and we see some in the Four Seasons slideshow, the sky is just perfect and it's dark down below. It's because there's not enough latitude to capture both areas of that contrasty scene. And today is a perfect illustration. too much light. What we need is God's umbrella, clouds out there to even the light seen out from shadow to highlight. Plus, on a shadowy, softer lit day, the angle of the light bounces all around and fills in the shadows. Today, the sunlight is what? Straight.
What kind of film is best on a day that has a lot of contrasty light?
Again, lots of latitude.
So it'd be a slow 25?
For slides. Though I wouldn't shoot, frankly, I wouldn't shoot anything in this bright light. I would go and find scene, unless I would also use a polarizing filter. But it's a beautiful scene and I do shoot it. But what I would still look for is something in the shadow, or provide my own shadow, though I didn't bring it. You can buy this big circular, you put in the car window, those things that fold out into this little circle. Many nature photographers bring those around and have either carry it themselves and hold it out over the image to flatten the light out so that the latitude problem is solved. But those of you shooting prints, most of those images exceed the latitude and overexposed white or too dark in the same scene.
I had another question. Mm-hmm. When you were talking about the difference between positive film, print film, and negative film,
right,
or slides. And if you're shooting a picture where you're intentionally underexposing a shot, with prints, it's going to be overexposed on the print? Is that what you said?
No.
You say it was opposite of what you would do with a slide.
Right.
So what, if I'm intentionally...
But you're overexposing the negative for detail, which allows, in other words, there has to be something in the negative for the light to pass through to make a scene. If you don't have it, if the negative is blank, which is terribly underexposed, you will end up with a black spot on the print. However, the more and more detail to get a white coat, for example, in a white coat will appear what in a negative?
Black.
Black. And it blacks the light, mm-hmm, to make it white underneath.
So if I have a scene where I want to intentionally make it darker, but
okay,
I have print film,
you would underexpose to make everything darker.
But I would do the same with slide film. Okay.
Yeah, but the thing is you're talking about the negative versus the positive.
Well, I'm just talking about the end product, you know.
Right.
I mean, here I'm just
right,
trying to get this picture.
Yeah.
Okay,
let's do that one more time. Let's to get a perfectly white slide, what do you have to do? Overexpose the whole thing. That's why you have to overexpose snow to get white snow. All right. Now, to get a good snowbank in the negative, you have to overexpose the negative, which will then make on the print, as the light gets blocked by the negative, a white snowbank. Now your question was, how do I make a dark print or a dark slide? Well, a dark slide results from underexposure.
And a dark print.
And a dark print.
Right. But first you have to underexpose the negative.
We don't touch the negative.
Well, you do. You create the negative. Let's work our, we'll do it on the board here. Yeah, it is confusing, and ultimately the light meter doesn't care, but you do. So let's work on that.
To simplify, overexpose, does that mean you're going from your f-stops up or down, like...
Okay, let's go through that quickly, because that's ultimately, we have to talk about that. Which lets in more light, f2 or f22?
F2.
Another way to remember it is, which hole is bigger? Which would you rather have? One half of a piece of a pie or 1/22nd of a pie? We'd all prefer the bigger piece of pie, right? Mm-hmm. The analogy, a bigger opening. So as someone said earlier, most people keep the shutter speed the same and use the f-stops to overexpose, let in more light, go towards f2, or let in less light, go towards f22. Okay.
Yeah, that's what I do, is that what you're supposed right. to do?
Yeah, and that's perfectly fine hand-holding, because most people unconsciously would start dropping down towards what? 1/30th, 1/15th? And we're not even thinking about it, and then attempting that shot, and you would be luring it. Those of you with light meters that control, give you that choice, in many manuals, if you read the manual carefully, you can discover, indeed, you can switch to f-stop priority or shutter speed priority. I would encourage you, if you're hand-holding it, to always use the f-stop priority for the, and let the meter pick the f-stop. However, what does the meter care about depth of field? Nothing. And that's what we're going to get to tomorrow. So quickly, let me do a little reprise here, and then we'll deal with our image problem, because it's the most important factor. You're right on the problem that everybody has. I went to a workshop this last spring where one of the instructors had it wrong about slides. So, yeah. But as a result of this brief hour, let me reassure you, if you can control just this information, your work will improve enormously, and you know much more than most people running around again. So let's go through it quickly. First of all, every year change the light meter battery. If you haven't changed your battery in a while, meaning you can't remember when you changed it last, you're probably getting some bad results because of that.
Does it make any real difference if you have it, if you just leave it on all the time, your battery?
It depends on the camera. This camera and these FMs and FM2 shut off the battery, even when it's turned on, if you leave it set. Some of your cameras will run the battery right down.
Most of them recommend putting it on bulb or manual, and it will drain your battery.
And the more you use your VCR, your video camera on Zoom, or the more, those of you with autofocus, right? The more you do all that stuff, the batteries go faster and faster and faster. And that's a sad thing, because most of these batteries are extremely potent chemicals, and in some cases, not in all cases, batteries are considered hazardous waste. So you don't dare burn them with the trash, and you certainly need to find somewhere in your community how to dispose of them correctly. But don't just throw them in waste baskets. The lithium batteries are especially potent and will poison you if they crack open. Also, batteries die in the cold. The colder the battery, the more it slows down, just like us. Okay, so change the battery. Secondly, read the manual for your camera carefully again and again until you really think you have a sense of what the manual is telling you. Change and load your film carefully. Again, those of you who have loaded your film in bright sunlight, popped it over here. And by the way, once you do put it on this side, and we'll talk about this, and you're supposed to tighten the tension slightly if you have a manual camera, if the camera's doing this for you. Watch that cable move over here, that crank. If it's not moving, guess what?
Your film is not going
through the camera. How many of us have done that? All right, we've all done it. This is how you prevent it, just watching the crank. Those of you with automatic cameras, that's just out of your concern. Fortunately, it seems to do it right, except on my little camera that's automatic, if you load it wrong. Secondly, heat will damage your film. If you've ever gotten your prints back or your slides back and there's this yellowish, greenish haze over everything, that's from excess heat. Leaving this in the glove box of your car, or even setting out backpacking for just 5 to 10 minutes, this thing gets up to way over 100 degrees quickly because of the black. That's why I prefer now the shiny body. So you pay more money to be cool with the black. And lastly, as we control the camera meter, first on the subject and then compose, and by the way, your light meter is generally in the center, and so if you want this bright contrasty scene anywhere else but in the center with PhD meters, it's now metering off this dark area over here. So if you have a PhD meter, some of them have a freeze button on the exposure. You meter and you freeze it, and then you can go compose with that object, not centered. Which, by the way, is a wonderful composition cure. Go back and look at your work, and if it's all centered, that's why it tends to look blah, because your eye is not seeing everything centered in that world. Then, make sure you're hand-holding it fast enough. The 60th of a second at a minimum, if you're breathing correctly. If you're not breathing correctly, 1/125. But then if you're hand-holding, what typically are you doing? Except for a beautiful day like today, you're down at F4, F2.8, F2, which is negatively affecting depth of field. However, that also could be a positive. For example, if I were shooting a portrait right here of these two people, there's that sign and stuff behind them. Shallow depth of field blurs the background and makes it look pleasing, because I'm only getting the couple of feet sharp where they're sitting.